successive bombing runs by Boeing B-52 long-range strategic bombers, each carrying in its bomb bay multiple thermonuclear weapons, are each capable of thousands of times the destruction of the atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japan. Each time the briefer described a new wave of attacks, Rubel wrote, "The two men on their stepladders A you would untie another pair of red ribbons, a plastic roll would come washing down and Moscow would be even further obliterated beneath the little marks on those layers of plastic sheets." A what shocked Rubel most, he wrote, was that with regards to Moscow alone, A's plan called for a total of 40 megatons or megatons on Moscow, about 4,000 times more than the bomb over Hiroshima and perhaps 20 to 30 times more than all the non-nuclear bombs dropped by the Allies in both theaters during more than 4 years of World War II. And yet, all during this meeting in 1960, Rubel sat in his chair and said nothing. Not one thing. Not for 48 years. But the admission is remarkably the first known instance where an attendee of this meeting dared reveal such personal details about what went on. Details that convey the simple truth to anyone outside that room, that this plan for nuclear war was genocide. The airmen descended the ladders, folded them up, tucked them under their arms, and stepped out of view. 4,000 times more explosive power than the bomb dropped on Hiroshima. What does this even mean, and is it something an ETMS brain can fully comprehend? More immediately, can anyone stop the plan for mass extermination before it happens? Chapter 2. The Girl in the Rubble. August 6, 1945, Hiroshima, Japan. The atomic bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima in August 1945 killed more than 80,000 people in a single strike. The total numbers are debated still. In the days and weeks after the bombing, no accurate counting of the victims could be performed. The mass destruction of Hiroshima TMS government facilities, its hospitals, police, and fire departments created a state of total chaos and confusion in the immediate aftermath. U.S. Strategic Bombing Survey map of Hiroshima TMS fire and blast damage. U.S. National Archives. 13-year-old Setsuko Thurlow was 1.1 miles from ground zero when this atomic weapon, codenamed Little Boy, detonated over Hiroshima at an altitude of 1,900 feet to an airburst, as it's RTMS known. This was the first nuclear weapon used in battle. Its burst height was based on a figure that had been precisely calculated by the American defense scientist John von Neumann, whose assigned task was to figure out a way to kill the most people possible on the ground below with this single atomic bomb. Exploding a nuclear bomb directly on the ground A you asked us a lot of energy, displacing massive volumes of Earth, as military planners had figured out and agreed. Setsuko Thurlow was knocked unconscious by this blast. When she first regained consciousness, Setsuko could not see or move. "Ayo, then I started hearing whispering voices of the girls around me," A she recalled years later, and that she could hear them saying, "Ayo, God, help me, mother help me." EATMM here. A sheltered by a collapsed building, Setsuko had somewhat miraculously survived the initial blast that comes with the detonation of an atomic bomb. Everything was very dark around her, she remembered. Her first sensation was that she had turned into smoke. After some time, mere seconds, or maybe minutes, it registered in her brain that the voice of a man was instructing her to do something. "Ayo, don't you TMT give up," the man said. "Ayo, EATMM trying to free you." This man, a stranger, was shaking Setsuko TMS left shoulder and pushing her from behind. "Ayo, get out, crawl as quickly as possible," A she thought to herself. At the time of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima, Setsuko Thurlow was an 8th grade student attending a school for girls. She was one of more than 30 teenage girls who had been recruited and trained to do top secret recording work at the Japanese Army headquarters in Hiroshima, which is where she was when the bomb went off. "Ayo, can you imagine," I Setsuko later reflected, "a 13-year-old girl doing such important work?" That shows how desperate Japan was. A in these early moments after the atomic bomb exploded, Setsuko realized this man was trying to free her from the rubble and it was important she take action or she would likely die. She pushed and pushed. Began kicking. Somehow, she managed to crawl out of the rubble and through a doorway. Ayo, by the time I came out of the building, it was on fire, she remembered. Ayo, that meant about 30 other girls who were with me in that same place were burning to death. The atomic bomb had been dropped out of a US Army Air Force's airplane, which at the time was the only way to deliver such a bomb to its target. The weapon was 10 feet long and weighed 9,700 pounds, about as much as a medium-sized elephant. A second plane flew directly behind the bomber plane, this one carrying 3 Los Alamos physicists, along with scores of scientific instruments with which to collect data. The bomber TMS actual yield, the force required to produce an equivalent explosion, was for years debated among defense scientists and military officials. Finally, in 1985, the US government settled on that number as being equivalent to 15 kilotons of TNT. A strategic bombing survey conducted after the war estimated that 2,100 tons of conventional bombs would have had to have been dropped on Hiroshima all at once to achieve a similar effect. Setsuko Thiller made it outside. It was early in the morning, but it looked like night. The air was thick with dark smoke. Setsuko saw a black object shuffling toward her, followed by other black objects that, at first, she mistook for ghosts. Ayo, parts of the bodies were missing, she realized. Ayo, the skin and flesh were hanging from the bones. Some were carrying their own eyeballs. A down the road a ways, Dr. Machihiko Hakaya, director of the Hiroshima Communications Hospital, had been lying on his living room floor, recovering from a night shift at work, when a strong flash of light, a one that indicated the atomic bomb had detonated, startled him. Then came a second flash of light. He was knocked out, or was he? Through swirling dust, Dr. Hakaya began to discern what was going on. Parts of his body, his thighs and his neck, were mangled and bleeding. He was naked. His clothes had been blown off. Ayo, embedded in my neck was a sizable fragment of glass which I matter-of-factly dislodged, Dr. Hakaya later recalled, and that he wondered, Ayo, where was my wife? He looked at his own body again. Ayo, blood began to spurt. Had my carotid artery been cut? Would I bleed to death? After some time, Dr. Hakaya found his wife, Yeko-san. Their small house was collapsing around the two of them and they raced outside, Ayo running, stumbling, falling, he remembered. Ayo, getting to my feet, I discovered that I had tripped over a Mana TMS head. Setsuko Thurlow, a TMS survivor experience, and Dr. Hakaya, TMS survivor experience, and countless others like theirs were for decades suppressed by the US Army and its occupation forces in Japan. The effects that atomic weapons used in combat had on people and buildings were kept classified and proprietary because US defense officials wanted that information for themselves. For another nuclear war, the Pentagon wanted to make sure it knew more about nuclear blast effects than any future enemy could possibly know. In flashes of energy and light, two atomic bombs, a one dropped on Hiroshima on August 6, 1945. And a second dropped on Nagasaki 3 days later, ended a world war in which 50 to 75 million people already had died. Now, starting in 1945, a small group of nuclear scientists and defense officials in the US began making new and bigger plans to use scores of atomic weapons in the next world war. A war that could be expected to kill, at minimum, 600 million people, one-fifth of the entire world TMS population. Which brings us back to the men seated in the underground bunker, in December 1960, listening to plans for general nuclear war. Chapter 3. The Build-Up, 1945-1990, Los Alamos, Lawrence Livermore, and Sandia National Laboratories. The plan for nuclear war being secretly shown at Strategic Air Command headquarters in 1960 had been a year or so in the making. It was ordered for the US President by the Secretary of Defense. 15 years had passed since the two atomic weapons were dropped on Japan, each one killing tens of thousands of people in an instant, with tens of thousands more people burning to death in the ensuing firestorms. Back in August 1945, the US had a third bomb ready to be shipped out, with enough nuclear material in its arsenal to produce a fourth bomb by the end of the month, which was the plan of action had Japan not surrendered. The original atomic bombs were like school science projects, I says Dr. Glenn McDuff, a long-serving Los Alamos nuclear weapons engineer and the former historian curator of the laboratory at EMS Classified Museum. 19 out of every 20 pieces of scientific equipment they had, explains McDuff, they designed and built themselves with only about 80 common vacuum tubes. With the World War finally over, the fate of the Los Alamos nuclear laboratory was an near TMS guess. After the war, with just one atomic bomb in the stockpile, the Los Alamos lab and town infrastructure crumbled, reflects McDuff. It was a daily struggle just to keep the lights on. Half the Los Alamos staff left. Things looked bleak. Until, that is, the Navy got involved. The U.S. Navy was by far the most powerful maritime fighting force in the world, and it was deeply worried about its looming obsolescence in this new age of atomic warfare. So it planned a live-action series of three atomic bomb tests for all to see. Atomic Test Baker burst through the lagoon surface, lofting 2 million cubic yards of radioactive seawater and sediment into the air in 1946. U.S. Library of Congress. Operation Crossroads was a grand, celebratory affair. A massive, public relations-based military test designed to demonstrate how 88 naval vessels could survive or even thrive in a future nuclear battle fought at sea. More than 42,000 people gathered at Bikini Atoll in the Marshall Islands. World leaders, journalists, dignitaries, heads of state, they traveled to this far corner of the Pacific to witness the live-fire atomic explosions. This was America TMS's first use of an atomic weapon since the war. A demonstration of what lay ahead. For a crumbling Los Alamos in 1946, Conway says McDuff. The Navy was their savior. Operation Crossroads injected the atomic bomb program with new life. By mid-1946, the American nuclear stockpile grew to 9 atomic bombs. After the test, the Joint Chiefs of Staff requested an evaluation of the atomic bomb as a military weapon to determine its next move. The reporter classified until 1975 set the burgeoning military-industrial complex alight. The details were alarming. Atomic bombs were a threat to mankind and to civilization, warned the group of admirals, generals, and scientists who authored the report. Weapons of mass destruction are able to depopulate vast areas of the Earth at EMS surface. But they could also be very useful, the group told the Joint Chiefs of Staff. If used in numbers, they wrote, atomic bombs not only can nullify any national TMS military effort, but can demolish its social and economic structures and prevent their re-establishment for long periods of time. The border TMS recommendation was to stockpile more bombs. Russia would soon have its own atomic arsenal, the report made clear, and that made America vulnerable to a surprise attack later to be known as a bolt out of the blue attack. With the advent of the atomic bomb, the board warned, a surprise has achieved supreme value so that an aggressor, striking suddenly and unexpectedly with a number of atomic bombs, could ensure ultimate defeat of an initially stronger adversary, meaning the United States. What America had created presaged its own potential demise. The United States has no alternative but to continue the manufacture and stockpiling of weapons, as the Joint Chiefs were advised. They took notice, and approved. By 1947, the U.S. stockpile rose to 13 atomic bombs. By 1948, there were 50. By 1949, 170. From declassified records, we now know that military planners agreed among themselves that 200 nuclear bombs provided enough firepower to destroy the entire Soviet Empire. But come summer that same year, the U.S. monopoly on nuclear weapons came to its inevitable end. On August 29, 1949, the Russians exploded their first atomic bomb, an almost exact copy of the one the US had dropped on Nagasaki 4 years earlier. The bomber TMS blueprints had been stolen from the Los Alamos laboratory by a German-born, British-educated, communist spy. A Manhattan Project scientist named Klaus Fuchs. The race to build even more atomic bombs now accelerated dramatically. By 1950, the US added 129 atomic weapons to its stockpile, bringing the total from 170 to 299. At the time, the Soviet Union had 5. The following year, in 1951, the number climbed again, this time to an astonishing 438 atomic weapons in the US arsenal. More than twice the number the Joint Chiefs of Staff had been told could depopulate vast areas of the Earth at TMS surface, leaving only vestigial remnants of Mana TMS material works. The next year, there was a near doubling of the near doubling yet again. By 1952, there were 841 atomic weapons in the US stockpile, 841. With the US monopoly on nuclear weapons now over, the race for nuclear supremacy had taken on a new urgency. Halfway across the world, the Soviets began building atomic weapons at a frenzied pace. In just 3 years, the USSR grew its arsenal from one bomb to 50. But the atomic bomb, owed its extraordinary power, its mass-killing capacity, would soon pale in comparison to what was coming next. American and Russian weapons designers each had radical new plans on their individual drawing boards. What followed was the invention of the most destructive, inhumane, and indiscriminate weapon ever created, in the words of a group of Nobel laureates. A climate-altering, famine-causing, civilization-ending, genome-changing, newer, bigger, even more monstrous nuclear weapon, one that the scientists involved called Aeth Super. Indeed, Aeth Super works better in large sizes than in small sizes, its designer, Richard Garwin, tells us, confirming for readers of this book that yes, I am the architect of the Super, of this first thermonuclear bomb. Edward Teller conceived it, Richard Garwin drew it at a time when no one else knew how. The year 1952 saw the invention of the thermonuclear bomb, also called the hydrogen bomb. A two-stage mega-weapon, a nuclear bomb within a nuclear bomb. A thermonuclear weapon uses an atomic bomb inside itself as its triggering mechanism. As an internal, explosive fuse, the Super TMS Monster's explosive power comes as the result of an uncontrolled, self-sustaining chain reaction in which hydrogen isotopes fuse under extremely high temperatures in a process called nuclear fusion. An atomic bomb will kill tens of thousands of people, as did the ones dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. A thermonuclear bomb, if detonated on a city like New York or Seoul, will kill millions of people in a superheated flash. The prototype weapon Richard Garwin designed in 1952 had an explosive power of 10.4 megatons, the near equivalent of 1,000 Hiroshima bombs exploding all at once. It was an atrocious weapon. Garwin, a TMS own mentor, the Manhattan Projector TMS Enrico Fermi, experienced a crisis of conscience at the very thought of such a horrifying weapon being built. Fermi and colleague Irabi temporarily broke ranks with their weapons-building colleagues and wrote to President Truman, declaring the Super to be an evil thing. Are their words, in writing, the fact that no limits exist to the destructiveness of this weapon makes its very existence and the knowledge of its construction a danger to humanity as a whole. It is necessarily an evil thing considered in any light. But the president ignored the plea to stop building the Super, and Richard Garwin was given the go-ahead to draw the plans. If the hydrogen bomb was inherently evil, it is TMS still evil, Garwin says. The Super was built. Its code name was Mike. The series was Ivy. So it was the Ivy Mike test. On November 1, 1952, it was test-fired on El Ajalab Island in the Marshall Islands. The Ivy Mike prototype bomb weighed around 80 tons, 160,000 pounds, an instrument of destruction itself so physically enormous it had to be constructed inside a corrugated aluminum building 88 feet long and 46 feet wide. Ivy Mike exploded with unprecedented yield. The bomb crater left behind was described in a classified report as being a large enough to hold 14 buildings the size of the Pentagon. And while there is much to say about the inhumanely destructive power of thermonuclear weapons in general, two aircraft photographs of before and after shots of the Ivy Mike bomb test to tell the story. In the top image below, Elijah Island appears as it had since its geological origin. In the bottom image, the entire island is gone. In its place is a crater 2 miles in diameter and 180 feet deep. Scorching the earth with mass extermination weapons had just been one-upped by an order of magnitude. The invention of the super brought with it the existence of a weapon that can vanish land. Elijah Island before and after the Ivy Mike thermonuclear bomb test in 1952. U.S. National Archives. What happened after U.S. war planners saw what 10.4 megatons could instantly destroy simply boggles the mind. What came next was a mad rush to stockpile thermonuclear weapons, first by the hundreds and then by the thousands. In 1952 there were 841 nuclear bombs. The next year there were 1,169. The process became industrialized, Los Alamos historian Glenn McDuff explains. These were not science projects anymore. By 1954, there were 1,703 nuclear weapons in the stockpile. The U.S. military-industrial complex was now churning out, on average, 1.5 nuclear weapons per day. 1955. 2,422, almost 2 bombs per day, and with 10 new systems introduced including 3 new styles of thermonuclear bombs. 1956, 3,692 bombs. The numbers continued to escalate to the point of dizziness. With production levels soaring, these mass destruction weapons were now coming off literal assembly lines at an average pace of 3.5 nuclear bombs per day. The frenzied buildup of the classified nuclear stockpile, U.S. Department of Defense, U.S. Department of Energy. By 1957, there were 5,543 bombs in the U.S. stockpile. That is, 1,851 new nuclear weapons in a single year. More than 5 per day. And the numbers kept growing. 1958, 7,345. And growing. 1959, 12,298. By 1960, when the U.S. war planners met in the underground bunker in Nebraska, the U.S. stockpile contained 18,638 nuclear bombs. By 1967, it reached an all-time high of 31,255 nuclear bombs. 31,255 nuclear bombs. Why stockpile 1,000 or 18,000 or 31,255 nuclear bombs when a single one of them the size of Ivy Mike, dropped on New York City or Moscow, could leave some 10 million people dead? Why continue to mass-produce thousands of these weapons when the use of a single thermonuclear bomb will almost certainly ignite a wider, unstoppable, civilization-ending nuclear war? A new term was afoot. A figure of speech known as a deterrence. To keep something from happening. But what does that even mean? History lesson number 1, deterrence. There are rules of nuclear war that guide U.S. nuclear policy. Concepts created by war planners starting in the 1950s to allegedly keep nuclear war from happening, while at the same time allowing war planners to figure out how to fight and win a nuclear war when it comes. Rule number 1 is deterrence, sold to the public as the idea that maintaining a massive nuclear stockpile is imperative for the purpose of discouraging nuclear attack. Deterrence guides nuclear policy. It works like this: each nuclear-armed nation builds an arsenal of nuclear weapons that it keeps pointed at its nuclear-armed enemy, ready to launch in a few minutes, ATM time. Each nuclear-armed nation vows never to use nuclear weapons unless they are forced to use them. Some people see deterrence as a peaceful savior. Others see it as doublespeak, asking, how could having nuclear weapons keep people safe from having a nuclear war? For decades, deterrence has allowed the Defense Department to build tens of thousands of nuclear weapons, their delivery systems, and a complex system of counter-weapons to defend against nuclear attack. Trillions of dollars have been spent on nuclear weapons. There is no way to know the total for sure because the true numbers are classified. Rule number one alleges to be simple. Deterrence keeps the world safe from ever having a nuclear war. But what happens if deterrence fails? Chapter 4, The SIOP, The Single Integrated Operational Plan for General Nuclear War. Less than 2 weeks after WEI ended, the US military requested 466 nuclear bombs for the stockpile, the first known, systematic estimate of nuclear bombs it thought necessary to destroy Soviet and Manchurian targets. US National Archives, as the US nuclear stockpile was multiplying out of control, so were each of the individual US military forces' ATM plans for nuclear war. As crazy as this now seems, before December 1960, each U.S. Army, Navy, and Air Force chief had control over his own stockpile of nuclear weapons, their delivery systems, and target lists. In an attempt to rein in the potential for mayhem from these multiple, competing plans for nuclear war, the Secretary of Defense ordered all of them to be integrated into one single plan, which is how the Single Integrated Operational Plan of the SIOPA got its name. In 1960, Strategic Air Command, later called U.S. Strategic Command, had 280,000 employees. To work on this new plan, 1,300 of them were corralled into a joint strategic target planning staff. Men and women whose sole job was to integrate all the individual target packages into a single target deck. This amalgamated plan is what John Rubel and his colleagues learned about that December day in the bunker beneath Upt Air Force Base. The secret plan that, if activated, would result in the deaths of at least 600 million people on the other side of the world. This plan for general nuclear war showed how the entire US military force would be launched at Moscow in a preemptive first strike. How defense scientists had carefully calculated that 275 million people would be killed in the first hour, and that at least 325 million more people would die from radioactive fallout over the next 6 or so months. Roughly half of these deaths would be in the Soviet Union ATMS neighboring Kowantrysa countries not at war with America, but who would be caught in the crosswinds. This included as many as 300 million Chinese. In 1960, the world ATMS population was 3 billion. What this meant was that the Pentagon had paid 1,300 people to compile a war plan that would kill one-fifth of the people on Earth in a preemptive nuclear first strike. It ATMS important to note that this number did not account for the 100 million or so Americans who would almost certainly be killed by a Russian equal measure counterattack. Nor did it account for another 100 million or so people in North and South America who would die from radioactive fallout over approximately the next 6 months. Or the untold numbers of people who would starve to death from the climate effects of a world set on fire. After the briefing was concluded, a second classified plan of attack was demonstrated, one that Rubel described in his 2008 memoir as being an AE attack on China given by a different speaker. It too involved similar theatrics with ladders and pointers and plastic sheets. Eventually, this speaker arrived at a chart showing deaths from fallout alone. The briefer pointed to a graph. It showed that deaths from fallout as time passed would be 300 million. Half the population of China, A. Rubel wrote. After some time, the meeting was adjourned. The following morning John Rubel participated in yet another meeting, smaller this time. It included himself, the Secretary of Defense, each of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Secretaries of the Army, Navy, and Air Force, and the Commandant of the Marines. Rubel recalled that the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Lyman Lemnitzer, A. told everyone they had done a very fine job, a very difficult job, and that they should be commended for their work. A Rubel recalled the army chief, George Decker, expressing similar congratulatory remarks.